Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, April 9th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, died at the age of 99.
Prince Philip was a man of service, motivated by a sense of duty to others.
Prince Philip earned the affection of generations here in the United Kingdom, across the Commonwealth, and around the world.
He addressed me in French, and I said, "You're speaking very good French for an Englishman." He said, "I'm not an Englishman, and I was speaking French before you were born."
We'll examine the prince's life and legacy with those who knew him, former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, as well as former Governors General David Johnston and Michael Jean. And a troubling surge in COVID-19 cases.
The race between vaccines and variants is at a critical point.
Cases are rising with another record day in Ontario. What can Canada do to win back the race? We'll bring in CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdou Sherkawi. Plus, the NDP gather for a national convention.
I think people want to see the priority on getting everyone vaccinated and making sure we care and support for people while they're going through this difficult time. That's what I'm focused on.
Singh is huddling virtually with his party today to hash out policy as pre-election speculations fly around political circles. What's on the agenda, and is his party ready for a campaign? We'll break it down with NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, then dig into both the NDP and Liberal conventions, which are both underway today with our Friday strategy session. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. It's the end of an era. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, has died at the age of 99. The prince was married to Queen Elizabeth II for over 73 years and has been by her side since the start of her reign, making him the longest-serving royal consort in British history. Born to Greek royalty in 1921, his life spanned nearly a century, which saw profound change throughout the world, including a world war, the fall of the USSR, and the repatriation of the Canadian Constitution. There's been a remarkable outpouring of condolences throughout the world, including from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. But as the UK heads into a period of mourning, how are Brits reacting to the no-nonsense prince? We're joined now by Paul Workman, our London bureau chief. He joins me now. He's right in front of the palace. Wonderful to see you, Paul. I know it's late over there. You spent the whole day in front of Buckingham Palace today. What was it like? Describe the scene and what people were telling you.
Good to be with you, Joyce. Well, people came to Buckingham Palace today, even though they've been told by the palace and by other officials of the government not to gather because of the pandemic guidelines and not to bring flowers. But of course, they gathered and they brought flowers and laid them in front of Buckingham Palace. More than one person here described Prince Philip today as a national treasure. And I think he'd probably bristle at that kind of description, quite frankly. There were tributes, of course, from all over the world. Vladimir Putin, for example, Barack Obama. And you'd expect those kind of tributes from presidents and world leaders and prime ministers. But we also heard from Mick Jagger today, who said that, you know, he was quite saddened to hear of Prince Philip's death, and that his own father, Mick Jagger's father, had worked for some of the charities that Prince Philip had been the patron of. So he said today that he will be quite fondly remembered. So we're hearing from people in all walks of life, entertainers, leaders, politicians, for a day that this country and the royal family went into mourning, perhaps for 8 days. We're not sure yet, Joyce. We're waiting to hear more about that from the Queen herself.
And we know, Paul, that Prince Philip did not want a big fuss for his funeral. And with, you know, COVID-19 protocols in effect, how will his funeral service be different? He will get what he wants, not a big funeral, not a big state funeral. But how will they organize this?
Well, he will get exactly what he wanted, but he really, Joyce, he never really wanted a state funeral. He made it clear that he was not going to have a state funeral, he was not going to lie in state, but there was sort of planning for a 9-day period of mourning here. That's gone, that's out the window because of the pandemic. And so now Prince Philip will lay at rest, as they're saying, at Windsor Castle. The funeral will be sometime in the coming days. We're not sure yet when. The Queen, probably in consultation with her family and with the British government, will decide when the funeral will be, who will be there. Under guidelines, COVID guidelines here, you're really not supposed to have any more than 30 people at a funeral. And so that will really make things a little more complicated. It will likely be perhaps a small family affair. Will there be international guests? That seems unlikely, but we're, again, waiting to hear those details from the Queen herself.
A sad day indeed for the Queen. I mean, it's her husband of 73 years. Our London Bureau Chief, Paul Workman, in front of Buckingham Palace. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks, Joyce.
And our next guest holds many memories from his time with the late Prince Philip. Former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and the prince's friendship spanned decades. And joining me now is former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. Hello, Prime Minister. Very nice to see you. Happy Friday.
Thank you very much.
I know that you've met Prince Philip on a number of occasions. You probably even had a relationship with him. You are two unscripted, outspoken gentlemen. What can you tell us about him? An anecdote that best describes the person that he was.
Well, he was a great guy. He was very direct. It was always very pleasant to be with him. He was not very shy to speak up his mind, apparently sometimes too much. Privately, he was kind of a very curious, knowledgeable, easy to talk with guy. And I met him the first time in 1968 during the centennial of Canada. And after that, I spent times in the north with the Queen and the royal family. I had to deal with them when I did the patriation of the Constitution. I had to go to London to visit with them at that period. And anyway, there was a Commonwealth time during what time I was Prime Minister. So at every meeting, I would have chit-chat with conversation with them, official, and sometimes just chit-chat. And eventually, the Queen made me the Order of Merit about 11 years ago. And so every year or every year and a half, I will go to London at Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle and have meetings and cocktail and lunch with them. And it was extremely pleasant. And I was very honored to be the fourth Canadian to be receiving that from the Queen since 1902.
What would you say to a younger generation? Because, you know, many Canadians over the decades have seen him, you know, grow into his role and grow old. But what would you tell the younger generations about this man that they probably don't know as well as sort of older generation Canadians?
You know, his role was very difficult because to be the husband of the Queen and in public, to be always two step behind her and be obliged to be very careful about what he would say and to be present everywhere. He was very generous with his time. He was involved in sports, in environmental organization, and he was very much helping different. He was honorary colonel of many regiments in Canada and probably all around the world. So it was a difficult role, but he had a great sense of humor and he did a fabulous job that was not an easy one to do and for a long, long time. And when the day that he announced that he was quitting more or less public life, I was at one of the meeting in London of the club, the Order of Merit, and he said to me, you know, I unveiled 20 or 25,000 plaque in my life. So that's enough. He was 96 at that moment. And he was playing his role. And of course, the queen had a very difficult role and problems with the family and so on. And I'm sure that he was there giving his best advice and probably having some authority as the father.
You know, when I heard the news this morning, my thoughts went to the queen. They were married for 73 years, and today she lost, her companion. She is a human being with a stiff upper lip indeed, but a human being. You have gone, sir, through this experience months ago. You lost your wife. If you could speak to the queen today about that, what would you tell her?
Oh, I will say that she's a great example to the world. That's what I will tell her, that she's facing a very difficult situation. But I will tell her I had many occasions to talk with her, official and non-official discussion, and she will be very courageous and she will take it with a lot of dignity, and she will carry on her duties as she always done. Since I think she's the queen now since 68 years, something like that. So she will be equal to herself. Strength and dignity.
Will you be talking to her? Do you have that kind of relationship with her?
No, I don't think it will be appropriate for me to do that. I will write to her certainly to offer my condolences.
Just one more question. The prince's legacy, Mr. Chrétien, what would that be?
But public service can be done with a lot of honor and class and keep your personality. He never disappeared completely. He was always there and everybody. He had an outgoing type of personality. He loved sport, loved the environment. He was very knowledgeable. He had gone to the war. He was an European from royal families. And so he had to carry a lot of burden all his life, and he always did that and kept his good sense of humor and his sense of proportion.
Honor and dignity. Jean Chrétien, thank you so much for these thoughts.
My pleasure.
Have a lovely weekend, sir.
And have a nice weekend, madam.
And we continue our coverage by reflecting on the legacy Prince Philip leaves behind in Canada. During his decades as royal consort, he visited Canada more often than any other member of the royal family. In 1959, he and the Queen visited every single province and territory in 6 weeks. Our next guest reflects on that Canadian connection. And joining me now is a former Governor General David Johnston. Mr. Johnston, lovely to see you. I hope you and your family are well there in Mont-Tremblant, Quebec. Many Canadians across many generations have seen, Prince Philip on television, grow into his role and eventually grow older and grow frailer, 70 years, of duty. But you are one of the few people who have had the opportunity to meet him in person. If you were to describe to us one anecdote or one time where you met him that best describes the man, what would it be?
Well, I would certainly want to comment on the remarkable contribution of service that he made. But to speak about the human Prince Philip, we were really lucky, Joyce. The custom is that before you're sworn in as Governor General, you go and pay your respects to the Queen. Sharon and I were sworn in at Rideau Hall in October of 2010. And in August, we were invited to go and meet the Queen. And we didn't realize at the time, but it was our good fortune that they spend August at Balmoral Castle in Scotland, which is it's really a great manor house. It's not a castle as such. And it's about a 1,500 acre estate in the Scottish Highlands. And they secure the perimeter, but within the manor house, the castle itself, it's very informal. And we went with every stitch of formal clothing you could imagine, Sharon's with high heels, and Friday evening just arrived and we had dinner with them, and Sharon and the Queen were planning on spending the Saturday morning in the stables. The Queen loves horses, and Sharon that time was managing a 36-horse stable on our farm in Waterloo. And she looked down at her feet, and she was wearing dress shoes, and the prince looked down their feet and kind of looked at his wife and looked at her feet and said, same size. And the Queen went up to her bedroom and came down with a pair of her brogues and had Sharon try them on there at the table. And she says, they fit, my dear. That's fine. So Sharon wore her shoes for the whole weekend. And that was the informality. And on the Saturday evening, it was so lovely. We had a barbecue at a renovated shepherd's hut or a small cottage about 4 or 5 miles away over these highland roads that were very narrow, not enough room for two cars to pass, at the top of high valleys going down a quarter mile or so. And the Queen was driving in her Land Rover, and I was with her, and Prince Philip was with Sharon, and he driving his Land Rover, who was in his early 90s then. And we got to the hut, and we had the venison that he had shot on the property the previous weekend, etc. And on the way back, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and it was as black as could be. And Sharon and the prince were in the car in front, and it was wandering a little bit on the tiny roadway because they were so engaged, and there were gales of laughter coming out of it as they exchanged stories. And I had that sudden thought, what if they go off the road? And what if they start tumbling down in the valley? Do the Queen and I scramble down to try to rescue them? And what if they're killed? What a story that's going to be. That all got along well, and the chemistry was good.
She will miss him very much. They were married 73 years. Can you imagine what she's feeling today?
I think enormous sadness and emptiness, and probably also a sense of he was her rock, as she expressed, and how important he was to our constitutional monarchy. And that's why I think of him as the leader, a servant. You know, we need that notion of leadership more and more today, where there's so much focus on individualism and not collectivity and stability and collaboration. But he was quite content to have her center stage and have the crown represented by the Queen in the center stage with a constitutional monarchy. And in that supportive role was really very selfless.
And I'm sure that the Queen tonight has a very heavy heart. David Johnson, Canada's former Governor General, thanks so much for sharing these thoughts with us, sir. Have yourself a very safe weekend.
Thank you, Joyce. Keep well.
Today, the world reflects on the life and legacy of Prince Philip, who served alongside Queen Elizabeth for 73 years of marriage. And here in Canada, we reflect on the royal consort's connection to our country. What does his legacy mean to our next guest? We continue our coverage today with former Governor General Michaëlle Jean. She joins us now. Lovely to see you, Michaëlle Jean. Welcome to Power Play. I'm wondering, what are some of your memories about Prince Philip's visits to Canada?
I would say that I have a fond memory of our first meeting together. And like the Right Honourable David Johnston said, we had also an opportunity to pay visit to the Queen and Prince Philip at Balmoral about, you know, the same time and of the year, and it was really nice to see how they tried really to make sure that we were comfortable, that we felt welcome, and they try really to take away every, you know, overwhelming protocol and personnel, so they could make it, you know, as intimate as possible. And we arrived with my husband and I, with our daughter, who was only 6 years old at the time. And first, as we arrived, they broke every single rule of protocol, because before we were pressured on what we could do, what we couldn't do. And the Queen and Prince Philip made sure that they could welcome us with open arms and right away hugs and welcoming us. And And also they greeted us in French. Prince Philip spoke French very well. He was raised also in French, which was also very elegant and respectful of him. A very affable, caring, elegant, and warm man. And you know what? Before leaving, some people were saying, were asking us, you think it's a good idea of taking your daughter with you to this important meeting? And I said, we go nowhere without our daughter. And it was really, really nice to see the special attention that he personally paid to our daughter. He was caring. And we spent 3 days with him at Balmoral. And the first dinner, it just so happened that it was my birthday. And it was really nice, you know, to see them knowing so much about me, my experience arriving from Haiti as a refugee to Canada, and listening very carefully and wanting also to engage and to be considered, you know, at a human scale. And that was really important. And I would say, Joyce, that one thing that I will never forget is as I was sitting next to Prince Philip, and he was talking to me about his favorite, you know, theme, which is the protection of the environment, global warming, and he was very passionate about it, and we were really having a good conversation on the matter. And at one point, I saw like a moment of sadness in his eyes, and I asked him. I said, it must be very gratifying for you to be really, you know, raising awareness about this important issue and everything. And he said to me, but you know, who cares? Once I know that the day I'll pass away, no one will remember. And the man was a pioneer. He was one of the first public figures and international, you know, leaders raising awareness about the environment, making like an urgent call, you know, for the right measures to be taken to protect the environment and to fight, you know, climate change. But there was this moment where I got the feeling of the depth of his loneliness. He was feeling maybe misunderstood. He was feeling maybe not appreciated, you know, to the proportion of his contribution. Same thing for his commitment to the youth. What I got from there, you know, how important for him it was to make sure that he could create opportunities, bursaries, programs for access to quality education for all. And he did that a lot. And I believe that this special sensitivity towards the youth came also from his personal experience. Yes. You know, he had a mother who suffered mental illness. He was a father who was not really there for him. He was in board schools, and that really shaped, you know, the character of the man, definitely. And so I think that it was an important you know, part of his character and how he wanted actually to connect and to be appreciated as truly, true value.
And truly a man of duty. I mean, a man who, a man of his generation who stayed two steps behind his wife for 73 years. Former Governor General Michael Jean, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Same to you, Joyce.
And coming up,
we're sort of living in a way at the tail end of a golden age. You know, it's been so amazing to have had the two of them together, married for 73 years. You know, no one really remembers a time when they weren't both around.
We continue our coverage on Prince Philip's last legacy with the British High Commissioner to Canada next. Stay with us.
You know, he's obviously a national treasure. You know, he made us laugh. He was He was brilliant. He was a great man.
But I think it just goes to show, you know, how many people remember Prince Philip already. I guess the legacy that he's brought to everybody in this country. I think the amount of people that he's touched.
I have a huge, huge amount of respect for the royal family. I'm quite emotional, actually, even just talking about it. The news broke as we were walking through Parliament Square, and my daughter and I just said, we just felt like we had to come down here.
And welcome back. We continue to reflect on the life of Prince Philip, who passed away this morning at Windsor Castle. He was 99 years old. How is our next guest reflecting on Prince Philip's life? British High Commissioner Suzanne Lejeune Dalgerzec joins me now. High Commissioner, it's wonderful to see you. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
I know we all woke up this morning with news that we can't really say was horribly surprising, but still quite sad. What was your reaction when you heard this morning, or maybe late last night?
This morning, sadness, as you say. You know, it's a really tough moment because, like many other people in the UK, I have grown up with Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, as part of my life. I mean, he's been there all the way through, and the fact that he's not around anymore is a big shock, even though, as you say, you know, at 99, we all knew it was going to happen. But I think it's still a big shock to all of us.
That's interesting that you talk about people of yours and my generation. I'm wondering, do you think that younger Brits, that younger people have the same affection for him than maybe older generations have?
I think they do because of the support and the obvious help that he's been to Her Majesty the Queen, or that he was to Her Majesty the Queen. You know, they had a marriage that lasted 73 years, which is quite extraordinary. And I think people who have who've seen that admire that. Admire the fact that, you know, for a man of his generation, you're talking about generations, for a man of his generation to be the number two and to be in a consort role was extraordinary, very unusual and really difficult. And he carried it off with grace and paved the way for other men who fulfilled a similar role, you know, in following generations. So I think, yes, and of course, people have got to know a little bit more about his backstory through the Crown. You know, that's a fiction, but I think there are elements of his youth which people weren't so aware of. And, you know, had a really, really tough childhood. And I think those parts of him people have got to know a little better in recent years.
It's interesting, you know, we've heard stories, like you say, all day about Prince Philip, his youth, his marriage to the Queen, you know, how difficult it is for a man of his generation, you said it, to walk two steps behind his wife for 73 years. What do you think is his legacy? I mean, this is a man who was not, who was a consort, and, you know, the Queen's, you know, pillar, I'm told. But what is his legacy?
I think there are a number of areas where he made a huge difference. And because he wasn't flashy about what he did, I think people can tend to underrate those things. For young people, he set up the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme, which was quite groundbreaking when it was set up, which was to encourage and develop leadership in young people. That's been an extraordinary scheme, which was taken up by lots of countries around the world in the Commonwealth, including in Canada. And lots of young people became much better leaders and went on to great things as a result of that scheme. He was also an environmentalist and with an genuine interest in nature and preserving our environment before it became fashionable to do so. And he was also, people don't know this about him, but he was also really interested in innovation and finding solutions to things. So engineering and the way in which engineering could transform our world. So I think there are a number of different facets to him which we will appreciate more and more as the years go by. And I think also, you know, as well as all that stuff, he was a devoted father and grandfather and great-grandfather. And of course, this is also a family that is mourning the loss of a very, very important family member.
Yes, my first thoughts were actually, when I heard about it, for the Queen, a husband of 73 years. It must be, you know, very difficult for her. I know she's a woman who keeps a stiff upper lip, but I'm sure her heart is aching tonight. Suzanne Lejeune Dalgerzec, thank you so much for sharing these thoughts with us.
Thank you, Joyce.
And coming up, variants are to blame for the latest surge in cases leading to record ICU admissions in Ontario. How quickly can Canada crush this third wave? CTV News infectious disease specialist Dr. Abdou Sherkawi joins us next. Don't go away.
Even as vaccines are bringing us closer to end this crisis, we cannot afford to give this virus an inch.
And welcome back. Ontario sets a grim new record for ICU admissions today. 552 people are in intensive care battling COVID-19 related illness. The province also reported 4,227 new cases, the second highest single-day jump since the start of the pandemic. These somber numbers come a day after Ontario's stay-at-home order came into effect. So is this a case of too little, too late? Can the province turn things around? Joining me now is Dr. Abdou Sherkawi, CTV News infectious disease specialist. Welcome to Power Play, doctor. I wish we had better news to talk about, but we seem to have the same conversation. Always lovely to speak to you, but we seem to have the same conversation over and over and over. So how do we change this conversation? People are now, there's a stay-home order. Is this going to work? What do politicians have to do more? What should we do more to stop this rise in cases?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that this is something that has been recurrent, because we shouldn't be here. Simple enough. We knew what we were up against in the first wave, never mind the second wave. And now that we are dealing with variants of concern, we are challenged more than we've ever been before. That means that we can't rely solely on vaccination. We have to make sure that the vaccination plan is tied to very unequivocally elucidated public health messaging, and in terms of the support mechanisms that are in place for those that are disproportionately affected. I think I was very vocal about not hiding my displeasure that Premier Ford unequivocally declined to offer paid sick leave for essential workers, and frankly passed the buck on to the federal program, which is not designed to really manage this crisis and is a retroactive process. You know, until we figure out that we're going to have to do things to gain the trust of essential workers, to actually value them and recognize that they are the ones that are disproportionately driving this third wave right now, we're going nowhere. The vaccines will help. There's no question about that. But they can't help quickly enough. And I'll tell you, if we don't change our strategy right now, we're going to end up with a fourth wave. It's a question of how big that wave is going to be, not if it's going to happen.
I know, and we never have happy conversations, you and I, but now another consequence of this is that Ontario hospitals have been directed to ramp down elective surgeries. Doesn't mean just surgeries you want to have, it's surgeries you need to have, and non-urgent activity starting on Monday. So we don't have a lot of time, Dr. Sherkawi, but speak to us about that, because that also is something we don't talk about, but is happening across the country.
Yeah, this is the collateral damage from not having resources being freed up and allocated to deal with all health issues that are non-COVID related. That may be a cancer-related issue. It may be debilitating joint pain that requires surgery for a replacement. It may be a transplant that has to be put on hold because the intensity and the amount of human resources and other resources that are needed to manage COVID patients is huge. And now we're getting into the real concept of triage, what that's going to mean, having to make very difficult choices that are going to cause insufferable consequences for a lot of people. And that's just a tragedy that we're going to have to live through because we didn't prepare.
Yeah, sad news, but that is what is going on now. Dr. Abdou Sherkawi, as usual, thank you so much for this. Have a good
weekend,
sir.
Thank you, Joyce.
And coming up, new Democrats are gathering virtually as their national convention kicks off today. This could be the last convention before an election. So, are the NDP election ready? We'll hear from NDP leader Jagmeet Singh next. Stay tuned. And welcome back. Thousands of NDP party members have gathered online around its convention's central theme, inequality. But will controversial proposals snatch the spotlight? Resolutions around things like phasing out the military died before making it to the virtual floor, but the docket includes proposals like abolishing billionaires. Can the party stay on track to plan for a potential election? How is party leader Jagmeet Singh mobilizing the delegates? Let's find out. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh joins me now. Nice to see you, Mr. Singh. I hope you and your family are well. You know, you have your convention that's starting today, going through the weekend. This is, you know, most likely the last convention before an election is called, whether by the opposition, whether by the minority government. I know you said that you don't want an election, that this is not time for an election, but are you preparing for one just in case?
Absolutely, Ms. Napier. We are ready for an election, but I want to again make the case that while people are worried right now about the third wave and variants, we're seeing lockdown in Ontario, numbers rising in Quebec and in BC. These are the three most populated provinces. This should give any government pause. We've said Justin Trudeau should be focused on vaccinating and getting vaccines into people's arms and not focused on an election. We'll continue to make that case, but we are ready. We are ready to fight an election to make sure people know that we will be there for them, to fight for them, to get them the help they need.
Okay, when you say you're ready to fight for them, because it seems that, you know, over the last months or since the beginning of this pandemic, the Liberals have been, you know, sort of taking NDP policies and making them theirs. People describe this as the Liberals eating the NDP's breakfast. So you tell me, what will you offer once this pandemic is, you know, under control? What will you and what are you offering voters out there that the Liberals are not offering?
Well, I think it's a very important question, and I want to lay out this case. The Liberals, for one example, started wage subsidy at 10%. That is just a symbolic gesture. That was their offer to Canadians to cover 10% of their salaries to keep them employed, and that was not good enough. We fought, we pushed, we wrote joint letters, we brought together people, and we won that wage subsidy was increased to 75%, meaning 75% of a worker's salary was covered to keep them employed. Hundreds and thousands of workers kept their jobs because New Democrats were there. If the Liberals were left to their own devices, it would not have been enough help. When it came to people who could not work, who lost their jobs, we doubled the amount of money that Canadians received, again, making sure people were able to put food on the table and pay their bills. Without New Democrats, we would not have got the paid sick leave at the federal level or help to students. So again and again, we see that the Liberals try to do the minimum or try to do a gesture. We fought to get the maximum for people. And that's exactly what we're going to continue to do. And we've got some other examples of how the Liberals are not like us. They voted against pharmacare. They voted against getting rid of profit in long-term care. And they voted against bringing in a wealth tax on the ultra-rich. So they've shown again and again they're on the side of the wealthy, not on the side of people.
But you have some fairly controversial resolutions that you will have to debate and vote on at your convention, on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, on the phasing out of the military, as you are asking the military to help in the vaccine rollout. Your party wants to phase out the military. You need this party to be united and to come out of this convention united if you want to be election ready. How are you going to do that?
Well, a lot of the resolutions you mentioned were not prioritized. So the membership did not make that a priority, and that's why we're not going to have to debate those. But we'll have a healthy debate on things that matter to Canadians. The majority of the motions and resolutions that got prioritized are ones that speak to what people are going through. Increasing access to health care, which we know is something very relevant to what people are worried about. Making sure the wealthiest pay their fair share, that it's not workers that lost their jobs or small businesses that shut down in this pandemic that have to pay the burden of the cost of the pandemic or recovery, it should be those at the very top, the ultra wealthy and the ultra rich, that pay their fair share. So a lot of the priorities of the party are directly related to what people are going through.
NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, I know you're also giving a speech on Sunday. We will be following that. Have a wonderful convention, sir.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
And it's been 851 days since Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor have been detained in China. And 3 weeks since their Chinese trials ended without a verdict. Kovrig and Spavor are accused of espionage by the Chinese government, which they both deny. The arrests are widely seen as an act of retaliation for Canada's arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, our strategy session digs into the NDP and Liberal conventions, both underway right now. Stay with Power Play. And welcome back. It's a weekend of dueling political conventions. The Liberals and NDP are meeting virtually for what could be their last major conventions ahead of an election. How are the parties preparing for a pandemic trip to the polls? All eyes will be on former Bank of England leader Mark Carney, who addresses the Liberal convention tonight. And the NDP convention will sift through resolutions tackling everything from federal minimum wage to adding the word socialism into the party's constitution. What are our strategists watching for this weekend? Let's bring them in. Greg McEachran from Proof Strategy leans Liberal. Toronto Sun editor-in-chief Adrian Batra is our conservative voice. NDP National Director Anne McGrath is taking time out of her party's convention to join us tonight. Well, let me start with you, Greg McEachran, because all eyes will be on the speaker tonight, Mark Carney, former governor of the Bank of Canada, of the Bank of England. For years, people have been wondering whether he's going to dive in. Is he going to be in politics? Is he staying out? Is he in? Is he out? What are you looking at in his speech tonight?
Well, I think what the Liberals have accomplished here is got a conversation going. It's, as you said, it's dueling conventions. So they've got, you know, someone who's very well known on the world stage. Whether or not we're going to see Mr. Carney eventually as a candidate, still up in the air. He does seem to be really interested in politics. So I think we, you know, we'd want to factor that in. But this is going to be a time when we're hopefully finally through this pandemic, even though it feels like we're in a brand new one at this point. We have to think of some really startling, big, broad ideas. And having someone that's experienced on the world stage, like Mr. Carney, is not a bad thing for to include in your convention, but also to be listening to and making suggestions and providing, you know, some potential solutions.
And, you know, it was interesting. I asked Mr. Singh that question about how are you going to differentiate yourself from what the Liberals are offering, and that will be his speech tonight. But that is probably the party's biggest hurdle.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important when we look at the contrast between the Liberals and the NDP is the whole issue of words and actions. So, for instance, I'm hearing pretty strong signals coming out of the Liberal Party convention about and in the kind of lead up to the budget about some kind of a throw around childcare. And, you know, people are interested in that, and I don't blame them, because for so many women it's such a critical, and so many families it's such a critical issue. But I can tell you that my children were about three or four, my youngest, when the Liberals first promised a national childcare program, and that was back in 1993, and they're in their 30s now, their mid-30s, the youngest ones. So, PharmaCare, you know, the PharmaCare was promised in 1997. So I think that the contrast for us is going to be words versus action. I think that we are very used to hearing Liberals campaign on and talk about very impressive progressive things, but when it comes to doing something about it, whether it's clean drinking water on First Nations reserves, getting rid of the first past the post electoral system, tackling climate change, with real meaningful action, any of those kinds of things, their money isn't where their mouth is.
Adrian Batra, when you watch these two conventions, the Conservatives had theirs a few weeks ago. What are you looking at? I mean, these are, at least the Liberals are, you know, are going, are in majority territory, according to polls. What are you looking at in these two, for these two conventions?
Well, I think with the anticipation, of course, that these will likely be the last ones before some sort of election, if that's in the offing. So the election readiness, certainly, we know that the NDP has some money in the bank. The Liberals are well-financed, and the Conservatives certainly are. But the buzz that I'm hearing from my Liberal contacts, and this may surprise Greg, but yes, I do indeed have some Liberal contacts, they are really kind of buzzing around. They're buzzing around with respect to Mark Carney. You know, that's the name that keeps coming up. He's been in and around, hovering and around the Liberal Party and whatnot for some time. Will he, won't he? That seems to be the most interesting part of what's going on from their side of the aisle. And with respect to the NDP, you know, I think you presented it to Jagmeet Singh quite well, Joyce, and that's with respect to some of these controversial issues. Yeah, they may have put the disbanding of the military on this on the back burner, and he rejected that, and rightly so. But what other aspects of the soul of the NDP are they going to be putting forward? And no one knows better than me that, you know, policy conventions can be overtaken by extreme factions on any side of your party.
Yeah.
So those resolutions continue with their, yeah. We'll look for those.
Unfortunately, guys, that's all the time we have. I am so sorry, but we'll have more time next Friday. Thanks for being there. And that's your Power Play Day in politics. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back right here on Monday. We leave you tonight with a live look at Windsor Castle, where mourners have been gathering throughout the day, paying their respects to the late Prince Philip.